as a conclusion of our topic about the dreams and visions of the world's destiny, I want to discuss briefly about the issue of messianic speculation within Sefer Daniel. We had left off last week that there are a number of cryptic time frames that are stipulated throughout Sefer Daniel, especially in the latter part of the Sefer. We talked about the cryptic time frames of until for a time, times, and half a time, 2300, evening, morning, 1290, yamim, 1335, yamim. So we want to just give you a taste of the history with regard to whether we are allowed, whether we should analyze these numbers according to our contemporary times and devise through our mathematics dates for the coming of the Mashiach, or whether this particular enterprise is something that is completely forbidden, although notwithstanding the numbers are in the Sefer itself. So Chazal in source number 8 maintain that one is not allowed to speculate using the numbers and time frames in Sefer Daniel about the coming of the Mashiach. Chazal in source 8 say, Amar Rabbi Yonatan, Tipach Atzaman, Shel Mechashevei Kitzin. Okay, does everyone see where I am in last week's booklet? Okay. Shehayu Omerim Kevan Shehigia Et Haketz Velo Ba, Shuv Eino Ba, Ela Chakelo. Rabbi Yonatan says, may those who calculate the days, the end of days, that their bones should be crushed because of the fact that when a particular date comes and the Mashiach has not yet arrived, it will cause tremendous despair and despondency and hopelessness among the people. However, what one should do is just chakelo, wait and anticipate for the coming of Mashiach, even if it is delayed, yitmahamea, chakelo, you should still anticipate and have bitachon that the Mashiach is going to come. With that particular attitude, we learn that Ibn Ezra, in his times, was extremely vociferous in his emphatic opposition to messianic speculation. And therefore, he tells us in source number 9 that there were a number of individuals who were speculating dates during his time period, and he very much rejects these particular interpretative enterprises. He says, the son of the potter, Ben Hayotzer, who is probably Abraham ibn al-Fakar in the early 13th century, composed a book about the appointed end, and I shatter his claim like a potter's vessel. Why? Because the time that he had predicted has already passed. And similarly, he castigates those messianic speculators who base their messianic speculations as well on astrology and on gematria, like Solomon ibn Gabirol, like Abraham Bar Chia, who wrote a work called Megillat HaMegaleh, and he says all of these are hevel ure'ut ruach. These are all vain and futile exercises. Why? Because Daniel lo yada haketz. Daniel himself says, I don't understand my visions. And if Daniel himself does not understand, even though the ketz, the time of the coming of the Mashiach, is embedded within the visions of Daniel, but if Daniel himself does not understand, who are we to try to figure out what they are referring to? With that qualification, however, it is interesting that Ibn Ezra nevertheless maintains that if a particular date and time frame within Sefer Daniel can refer to a period of time which has already passed, then one is allowed to assign these numbers to a particular period in Jewish history. So, for example, very interestingly, in source number 10, in the middle of chapter 8, we learn, just to go back to some of the content of chapter 8, it happens that in that particular chapter, you might remember, we encountered a vision of a ram as well as a male goat. And we had said that the angel had told Daniel that the ram is Paras Umadai, whereas the male goat is Greece. And it happens that in that particular context, it also had said that out of the male goat is going to arise an additional little horn that is going to break off from the four horns that are also going to spread out from this animal, because for Greece, after the death of Alexander the Great, it broke up into four principalities. So who is this little horn? Good question. This horn, according to chapter 8, rises up to the sky. It's as if trampling on the stars and the heavens, and it succeeds in throwing truth down to the ground. And in that particular context, we learned, and I gave you the psukim already back in on page 4, we learned that the angels are talking to each other, and they say, Ad matai hechazon hatamid v'hapesha shomem teit v'kodesh v'tzava mirmas. Until when is this vision of the Korban HaTamid being abolished? How long will there be desolation and trampling among the holy ones? And the answer is given that this quote-unquote little horn is going to succeed until 2300 evening, morning, Erev Boker. So Ibn Ezra maintains in this particular case, in source number 10, you can speculate about what this cryptic number means, because amazingly, he says, this refers to 2300 days. And that is approximately 6.5 years. Who is the little horn that has abolished the Korban HaTamid during the time of the Greek Empire, and who has trampled Emet the Torah? It is Antiochus Epiphanus, right? Antiochus the IV, Epiphanus. And so therefore the angels are asking, how long will Antiochus continue with his desecration of the Beit HaMikdash, placing idols in the Beit HaMikdash? And the answer is given 2300, according to Ibn Ezra, Erev Boker days, which is 6.5 years. What's interesting is that if you go through the historical records, this actually corresponds to the 6.5 years and about 4 months under the persecution of Antiochus the IV, which started in 170 BCE with the former high priest Onias the III murdered at the insistence of the wicked high priest of Menelaus, who was appointed by Antiochus. In 169, Antiochus murders the Jews. He loots the temples. This is all related in the book of the Maccabees. The persecution climaxes in 167. And in 164 BCE, the temple is rededicated, and that's what we celebrate on the holiday of Hanukkah. So Ibn Ezra says in this particular context, we already know what the numbers refer to, so therefore we can speculate about them. Nevertheless, he maintains that when it comes to the last cryptic numbers mentioned in the last psukim of our Sefer, number 1290 Yamim and 1335 Yamim, he maintains that the 1290 Yamim actually refer as well to 3.5 years, meaning he's understanding Yamim literally as days, in which case he speculates that actually these 1290 days are the days when it was a 3.5 year period before the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, that Titus had already abolished our korbanot, that he also had placed idolatry within the environs, the confines of our Beit HaMikdash, and only 3.5 years later does he actually destroy the Beit HaMikdash. So once again, this number 1290, Ibn Ezra historicizes. But what about where is anything referencing the future coming of the Mashiach? So in the very last date, 1335 Yamim, the Ibn Ezra maintains that that refers to a period of 3.5 years when we are going to suffer a tremendous suffering, Tzara Gedola. And we are going to suffer under an individual who is going to try to change Zimnin Vedat, right? Times and laws and seasons. And he claims that 1335 is very close to 1290. There isn't that much of a difference between them. And therefore, it's also approximately a 3.5 year period during which there will be eight tzara li Yisrael b'bayit sheni, eight tzara li Yisrael, that we are going to have tzara gedola lifnei bo ha-goel, i.e. the same 3.5 year period that we suffered tremendously before the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash by Titus, which is referenced in the 1290 days, the same approximate 3.5 year period, which is 1335 days, is the period of time during which we will have tremendous suffering in the 3.5 year period before the coming of the Mashiach. And he maintains as well that during this time, there's going to be a major clash between the kings of the north and the south, which he identifies with Christianity and Islam. The question, however, is when does this 1335-day period start? That's what he says is still cryptic. We do not know, because obviously he does not want to speculate with regard to the coming of Mashiach. And perhaps also as well, he is not certain that he is living in the time of Bi'at HaGoel, and therefore he does not want to give his people false hope. At the other end of the spectrum, we have the Ramban. The Ramban, who lived in Christian Spain, remember Ibn Ezra had lived in Muslim Spain, the Ramban who lived in the 13th century does calculate specific dates. He wrote a Sefer HaGeula that I had mentioned last week, a book of redemption. And in that book, he very clearly says that he's writing in order to comfort the people and to strengthen us while we are languishing in Galut. And one of the ways he felt he could do that is actually by calculating specific dates. And therefore, you have to understand that he is using the Hebrew chronology in order to calculate the dates. And he therefore maintains that the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, according to Hebrew chronology, is in the year 3828. Add 1290, he reads Yamim not as days, but as years. And that's part of the cryptic, enigmatic style of Sefer Daniel. You add them up, it adds up to 5118, which translates into our modern calendar to 1358 CE. According to Ramban, during this initial time period of redemption, we will have the arrival of the Mashiach ben Yosef. We will have the final war of Gog and Magog. And Mashiach ben Yosef is going to be killed in that war, but there will be preparations for the final redemption stage. Take 1335, subtract 1290, that adds up to 45. There will be a 45-year interim period after the first stage, during which afterwards there is going to be the arrival of Mashiach ben David in 5163, which is 1403 CE, and that's going to be the final inauguration of the Messianic Kingdom. Obviously, the Mashiach did not arrive in 1358 or 1403. So how does Ramban justify that he is calculating these particular dates? He disagrees with Ibn Ezra, and he maintains that while Daniel may not have initially understood his visions, later on he did achieve understanding at the end of his prophecies. And even more so, Ramban says that at the very end of Sefer Daniel, we read, Yishotetu rabim v'tirbe da'at, v'hamaskilim yavinu, that when the time of Mashiach is imminent, that we will be enlightened, and we will have great knowledge and great understanding. And therefore, the Ramban says, he apologizes to Chazal. And he says, I know you're so against messianic calculations. And yet he said, and he says, I know a lot have before me have made mistakes and the Mashiach did not arrive. And yet he says, he's so confident. We're closer to the time of Mashiach than Chazal were. And maybe the Messianic period really is arriving. He died in 1270, so he's not calculating the time so far away from his time. He says, Ulai batala hagzera. Maybe the decree against us is really been nullified. And he says, Achshav batalu mimenu ha-ta'anot ha'ele. All the tainus that claims that we should not speculate because of the this despondency and despair that would happen. He says, no, because anachnu b'acharit hayamim, we really are in the time of acharit hayamim. He says, on the other hand, let's be careful. It's only what I am saying is shema ve'efshar, meaning I'm also still speculating. Let's be very careful, he says. We're not nevi'im. Ein anu nevi'im. And yet, anachnu mekavim. He really, really feels so confident that the time of Mashiach is going to happen. Well, the Mashiach, unfortunately, did not arrive during those times as well. There are many later commentators who also speculate particular periods of time. Abar Benel speculates periods of time in the 1500s. Malbim is probably one of the latest commentators who speculates. He's an Eastern European rabbi and commentator. He lived from 1801 to 1879. What's amazing is that through his calculations, which will require me a whole hour to show you the mathematics, but he calculates dates of 1882, which interestingly is the first Bilu Aliyah movement. He calculates dates of 1913, 1928, which is the period of time of World War I. So it's very interesting how he also saw certain calculations, which are dates that seem to be can you switch me to the next file? That are very relevant in world history. How do we deal with all of this? It's really very simple. Remember, we talked about the divine plan being a flex plan, meaning perhaps many of these dates that our parshanim did calculate were because these dates were ripe for us to have the Mashiach arrive, but we weren't ready. We didn't merit, and we weren't ready, and therefore, unfortunately, we have to wait for an even longer future time. Remember, we had discussed even the opinion of Chaim Begadli Papa, which Rav Yaakov Meidan advocates, that the Mashiach possibly could have even arrived during the Hashmonaim period, during the Hanukkah time, had we merited. So we are still waiting and anticipating for the coming of Mashiach, and that's what we need to do. Move on to the new booklet. There is another very pivotal facet of Sefer Daniel that we need to discuss in the rest of this class and next class. And that is, while we've been very suffused in dreams and visions, there are also two very important incidents within Sefer Daniel that remind us that life in Galut is never simple. And that, in fact, despite Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's, as well as Daniel's political and administrative successes, they suffered tremendous challenges to their faith, persecutions, and they had to decide how they are going to staunchly maintain and uphold their religious beliefs in the face of persecution. In this perek that we are going to learn, we're going to do chapter 3, perek Gimel, for the rest of today. And that is going to describe how Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were willing to martyr themselves, to sacrifice their lives and be thrown into a fiery furnace. And we will learn in the last class, Perek Vav, when Daniel is willing to risk his life and he is thrown into the lion's den. I want to raise this question of Kiddush Hashem, of martyrdom, because we need to understand that there is no precedent. Sefer Daniel is the first examples of those who are willing to die al Kiddush Hashem. And we know the example, of course, from Chazal, of Avraham willing to be thrown into the fiery furnace because he was accused of smashing the idols. But this is Agadah, and we need to think about where are the remazim, the hints to this Agadah throughout Tanakh. But here we have Lefi HaPshat. We have explicit stories about Kiddush Hashem, about martyrdom. And the question we need to ask about sanctifying Hashem's name through giving up one's life, Mesirut Nefesh, is did these individuals, we're going to focus on today, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, did they have to risk their lives and die? Isn't it sometimes better to stand up to persecution of a foreign monarchy by living, staying alive, acting like a Jew every day, instead of dying for the sake of your faith? Martyrdom in Judaism is a big deal. It's an extreme act. It's not the norm. And therefore, the question is, what is it that prompted Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to feel that at this juncture, they had no choice but to be moser nefesh, to risk their lives at martyrdom? They didn't think they would be saved miraculously by Hashem. In fact, they say very emphatically, we're not guaranteeing Hashem is going to save us, and be thrown into the fiery furnace. Was there a way out? Was there a way halachically not to martyr themselves? And truthfully, halacha also develops around these stories, because in the Gemara, the Amoraim, our Chachamim, are trying to figure out what motivated them. Were they justified? Why did they do what they did? Could they have found a way out not to die, but to live? As we all know, the Torah teaches us very importantly, and we're going to talk about this afterwards, but in Vayikra we learn, Ushmartem el chukotai ve mishpatai asher yasel tam adam, what? V'chai bahem. You're supposed to live with them through the mitzvah, by the commandments, and not die by them. The norm is to live as a Jew. So let's just go through very cursorily. Let's go through the story just to get everyone to see, read the context, and then we're going to analyze it step by step. In Perek Gimel, which comes on the heels of the dream of the statue with all the different metals, remember the top of the statue, the head, was gold, which was interpreted by Daniel to refer to Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar, at the beginning of Perek Gimel, makes an image of gold. We don't know the timing of his building this image, but we are going to presume it follows, even if there's a time lapse, it follows after the dream of Perek Bet, and we discussed that most probably he had this dream after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. This particular image or statue of gold, is its height is of 60 cubits, its breadth is of 6 cubits. He puts it in the plain of Dura, Bikat Dura, which is in an area of Iraq, in the province of Babylon. You will see there are going to be many parallels that unfortunately we don't have time to elaborate on, but you can think of parallels with the building of Migdal Bavel back in Bereshit Yud Aleph. We are also going to see very interesting parallels to Mordechai not wanting to bow down to Haman, and I'm sure you could contemplate these parallels on your own. Nebuchadnezzar gathers together, and let's pay attention who he invites. He gathers together the satraps, prefects, governors, judges, treasurers, etc., the rulers of the provinces, to come to the dedication of this statue, which Nebuchadnezzar had set up. A herald cries aloud and he says, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the band, the symphony, strike up the music," and look at all the detailed descriptions of all the different instruments, "you are to fall down, bow down all at once to that statue that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. If you do not, you will be cast into a burning, fiery furnace." So, apparently, at least from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, he's probably on a palace balcony looking out. He sees that everyone, all the peoples, when they hear the music start, everyone falls down and bows down to this golden statue that he set up. Do you hear the repetition? Okay, but our first case of anti-Semitism, the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, accuse the Jews. And truthfully, that's a very lukewarm translation. It means they really wanted to eat them and crush them. And they say there are a few Jews who are not just lay people, they're your bureaucratic officials, and they did not bow down to the statue. Of course, the first thing they do is they say, oh, king, let us remind you of what you said. Didn't you say that everyone has to bow down, and anyone who doesn't bow down shall be cast into a fiery furnace? So, these three individuals, i.e., Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who are described by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar says, is it true that you didn't do what I told you to do? He says, okay, I'm going to give you a second chance. Obviously, he's very humiliated. These are his top officials. And of course, if they bow down now in front of everybody, that's going to even be better, right? It's going to make Nebuchadnezzar look even better. So he says, I'm giving you a second chance, but if you don't, you're going to be thrown into the fiery furnace. And he says, who is the God that shall deliver you out of my hands? So they say to him, and pay attention to the way it's written, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answer, and they say to the king, ... O Nebuchadnezzar, they don't even call him by his title, King Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to answer you. We're not doing this. We're not bowing down to this statue. And if we're not saved, it's not that God can't save us, but he chose not to save us at this particular point in time, but we're not bowing down to your statue. Well, we'll come back to the Malbim in a moment. What's the verdict? Nebuchadnezzar is very, very angry. And his whole face changes. Tzleim anpohi eshtani. He's really angry. He commands that the furnace should be heated up 7 times hotter than it was. In fact, the people that throw Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah into the fiery furnace get burned themselves. And they're bound up, they're tied up, and they're thrown in with their clothes on into the fiery furnace. And they fall down into the fiery furnace, all tied up. Later on, King Nebuchadnezzar looks inside. Apparently, there's like a side door that he can look inside, maybe where they fed the wood for fuel, to fuel the fire. And he said, didn't we throw in 3 people? I see 4. I see a 4th man walking around, and it looks like a divine being, Bar Elohim. So Nebuchadnezzar says, okay, come on out. He says, you are the servants of the Most God High, which is amazing how he doesn't necessarily switch over to monotheism, but he's definitely acknowledging that we have an unbelievable Hashem, of the Most High God, rather. And everybody gathers together, and when Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah come out of the fiery furnace, there's no fire on their bodies, their hair is not singed, their cloaks are not changed, they don't even have the smell of smoke on them. And Nebuchadnezzar then makes a declaration that he sends throughout his entire empire. And he says to everyone that we need to bless the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him. And they changed the king's word and they yielded their bodies and they refused to cower to me. And therefore, I make a decree that anyone who says anything amiss about our God, about the God of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, I'm going to cut them into pieces and destroy their houses. And he promotes them. He promotes Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in the province of Babylon. We never hear from them about them ever again, however, within the rest of the Sefer. So there's a lot of speculation among Chazal what happened to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. There are different opinions. One opinion is they made Aliyah. Okay, I want to go back to the story again, because I only did this very cursorily, so we have the overview. What is this statue? And why is it such a big deal? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah don't want to bow down to it. So your first gut reaction is going to be, it's an idol. And this is a cardinal sin of idolatry. And we have learned, yehareg ve'al yavol, that you should die and not commit idolatry. Sounds like an open and shut case. So we have two issues. Number one, we need to go back to the story in more detail. And we need to determine very closely, is it absolutely, without a doubt, without any ambiguities, without any loopholes, do we know from the storyline, the way it is told to us, that this is an idol open and shut case? That's point one. If not, we have a problem. Because if this is not meant to be idolatry, then what mitzvah do they think they would be transgressing? In which case they don't want to transgress it, so they're willing to martyr themselves. But then we're going to see there's another issue. Even if it's idolatry, and it's a cardinal sin, we are going to see that there are discussions among the Amoraim in the Gemara, that even in the case of Avodah Zarah, there might be scenarios in which case you can transgress idolatry and not die. There's a whole machloket among the Amoraim. And if there's one tiny way to have found a loophole that they did not have to die, but they could have lived halachically, then why did they choose martyrdom? How do we justify that? And how do we even say that we praise them as such? Because in later generations, during the times of the Crusades and beyond, this story has been used to justify why Jews felt when they were persecuted that they had to martyr themselves, even commit suicide before having to be persecuted or compelled to convert to other religions. So let's look at this very carefully. Nebuchadnezzar builds a statue of gold. Of course, this statue of gold is very, just get something out here. This statue of gold is probably not just gold, it's probably stone overlaid with gold. Gold is too soft. But this statue of gold should remind you of the golden image of the statue. That the gold at the top of the statue of his, the gold at the top of the statue of his dream was representative of the Babylonian Empire. So now you have to start to think, why would he make a statue of only gold? What message is he trying to send to his people? Is he trying to completely dismiss the dream interpretation and say, I am building a statue of completely gold, because what is message does he want to send to his people? I am going to be the eternal empire. But nevertheless, we have to take into consideration that later on in that dream, there was a stone that came out of nowhere that started at the bottom and destroyed the entire statue. But nevertheless, what does he say here to everyone? I'm not merely building this statue, but I'm getting everyone to gather together. And what do you all have to do? You have to bow down to this statue. Is he indicating, therefore, that he is making a very clear statement that everyone has to demonstrate their loyalty to his political sovereignty, to his absolute authority as the king of the world empire? And in doing so, it is as if he is saying the rest of the dream will never happen. Now, just thinking about this in this context, the question therefore should arise in our minds. Is this statue meant to be an idol, a pagan god in a completely absolute purist sense? Or is it meant to be like the statue of Lenin and in other countries where you're bowing down to a political sovereign? The caveat, however, is that we have to keep in the back of our minds is that Babylonian kings, especially Nebuchadnezzar, did consider themselves to be godlike, to be like deities. In fact, there's a very interesting text in Yeshayahu Perek Yud Dalet where Nebuchadnezzar is quoted as saying, something, it went off. Oh. where Nebuchadnezzar is quoted as saying that Ele al bamateav, I didn't quote you the pasuk in the text, in the source book, Ele al bamateav, I'm going to climb up to the above the clouds, Edame le'elyon, I want to be like the highest of highest, the highest God, like a God. So, in those days, there is not complete separation of church and state. Notice we have a lot of issues that we, complex issues that we need to take into consideration. Here we have, for example, the word Selim. The word Selim seems to mean a statue that refers to idolatry. And the word Selim in Tanakh is often used to refer to an idol. On the other hand, the term Selim doesn't mean only, exclusively, an idol, a pagan god. It often refers to an image, like we are created how? B'tselem Elohim. And in fact, you might have noticed later on in the text where I quoted you, when Nebuchadnezzar gets very angry, the text reads, Slaim anpoi eshtani, that the image, tselem, of his face changed, which is talking just about his facial appearance. Furthermore, if you pay attention, constantly within the early part of this story, is emphasized over and over again that when they are going to bow down and dedicate themselves to this statue, it is the statue that Nebuchadnezzar set up. Tzalma dihakem Nebuchadnezzar Malka, the king Nebuchadnezzar set up. Constantly repeating that. Why do we need to repeat that over and over if we're dealing with worship of a pagan god? In fact, we do not know what the shape of this statue is. We don't know if it's in the shape of Nebuchadnezzar himself or the shape of a god or some sort of animal that represents a god or some sort of other pagan type of visage. Furthermore, who's invited to this ceremony? If you pay attention, it's all the secular bureaucrats. The judges, the governors, the counselors, the sheriffs, the rulers of the provinces. If we would have thought that this is a cultic worship, that they are being invited to a ritualistic ceremony, who would you have expected to be invited? All the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the exorcists, the priests, and none of them are invited. In fact, Malbim maintains, if you want to know where Daniel is, and that's on page 2, I gave you the Malbim, he says Daniel wasn't invited. That's why he's not here in this particular episode, because of the fact people who were invited are not merely hedyotot, they're not lay people. And why didn't, by the way, the Babylonians slander about Daniel that he didn't bow down? Because Daniel wasn't there. Lo chala hapkuda, the command didn't apply to him to come because lo haya sar mimune al iro medina achat. He wasn't a political bureaucrat. He was the head, he was yoetz lamelech bilvad, he was the head of the wise men. And they apparently were not invited. On the other hand, if you go back to the text, you will see that there is a contradiction. Because later on it says that the herald says that everyone who is commanded, when you hear the music strike up, and by the way, music is often played during cultic ceremonies, so I'm going to constantly confuse you back and forth as to whether this is idolatry, ritualistic ceremony, a cultic motivation here, or something else, right? Not religiously, completely, exclusively religiously related. Even though there's music here, there are no sacrifices that are given. There's no priest to give any kind of prayers. We don't feel a religious atmosphere here, okay? But even more so, notice that when the herald cries out, he says, who is commanded? Peoples, nations, and languages. Amamaya, Umaya, Lishanaya. Who are we talking about now? Were there additionally just the masses? Many people from the different nations and peoples who are now under the empire of Nebuchadnezzar, have they been invited? Or are we actually talking about the governors and the rulers over these nations and different languages and peoples? So that's a question. Who is there? Why is this also going to be such an important question? How many Jews are at this ceremony? We know very clearly Daniel is not here. And I will admit that there are texts in the Gemara that criticize or don't fully understand why Daniel is not here in this particular scene. But who is here? How many Jews are here? Right now we only know about three, right? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Why is this going to make a big difference how many Jews are present? Are they part of this grouping, Amamaya, Umaya, Ulish, Vilishanaya? We will see it will make a big difference with regard to whether certain conditions are operative, that even if it's idolatry, whether this condition is operative or not might make a difference, that even if it is idolatry, do you necessarily have to die and not transgress? So, furthermore, when we go through the text, on the other hand, we see the verb sagad, to bow down to this tselem. We see the verb that is used, which is sagad. And this particular verb is used throughout Tanakh with regard to religious cultic worship. It's also interesting the size of this statue. It's 60 cubits in height, 6 cubits in width. I don't know how it didn't topple over, but if you look in the store in the Beit HaMikdash, the first Beit HaMikdash, the first Beit HaMikdash was 60 cubits in length. The second, that's in Malachim Aleph Perek Vav. In Ezra Perek Vav, the second Beit HaMikdash was 60 cubits in height. So the parallel between the size of the Beit HaMikdash, very interesting, because we also have the phrase Chanukat Tzalama. And one of the commentators, Rav Shmuel Masnut, says this seems to remind us of Chanukat HaMizbeach, right? Or the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash. We have very interesting religious echoes and intonations. Besides the fact that when everybody has to gather together and fall down at the same time, what does that remind you of? The Avodaya, right? In the Yom HaKippurim, when the Kohen says Hashem's name, everyone, right, has to bow down at the same time. So, of course, we're a little anachronistic here, but nevertheless, are there intonations that this might have a religious purpose, okay? What's interesting is that in the accusation of the Chaldeans, the Chaldeans accuse Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the following. O king, they have not regarded you. That's the topic sentence. Lo samalach malkateim. Accusation A. Le'elahach lo palachim. They do not serve your gods, and the verb palach is very cultic in its nuance. Second accusation. Uletzelem dahava dihakemta la sagadin. They do not bow down to this golden image, this golden statue. So now the question is, are they two separate accusations? By the way, they show that they are mordei malchut, that they're rebels against your monarchy, by A, not adopting your religion, they don't bow down to your gods, and B, they don't bow down to the statue. Two separate accusations, or are they really one and the same? By not bowing down to the statue, they're demonstrating that they don't bow down, they don't show obeisance and allegiance to your religiosity, your paganism. Things to consider. Nebuchadnezzar mentions about gods. Who's the God who is going to save you from my hands? And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah retort, even if Hashem won't deliver us, we don't count on that. We're not going to bow down. We're not going to serve your gods, and we're not going to bow down to your statue. Of course, mentioning about the fourth being, the Baal Elahin, who seems to have saved them from the fiery furnace. The fact that Nebuchadnezzar later on says that we have to, that his whole empire cannot say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, all seem to lean us in the direction of that this perhaps is an idol, that originally this had idolatrous in motivations, and that really we're talking about an issue of Avodah Zarah. But nevertheless, there are enough indications to raise ambiguities, to raise questions, whether this whole ceremony and the building of the statue was absolutely, unequivocally, no questions asked, open and shut case, that this is idolatry. And because there are ambiguities in the story about it, once again, the question is, could Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah have found a way to rationalize halachically that they don't have to die, that they could transgress, bow down to the statue, the Chai Bahem, continue to live as Jews in this among the foreigners and every day, right? As if being the face of Nebuchadnezzar, right? So let's talk about this. We have the psukim in the Chumash. They say on the one hand, in Vayikra Yudchet, you're supposed to live by the mitzvot, v'chai bahem, not die by them. On the other hand, in Vayikra Perek Chavbet, we learn that you are not allowed to desecrate the name of Hashem, but you're supposed to sanctify Hashem, v'nikdashti, b'toch b'nei Yisrael. That you are to sanctify Hashem among b'nei Yisrael. Pay attention to that phrase. The question is, how do you sanctify Hashem? Does it always have to be through death? Can you perform the act of sanctification of Hashem other ways? Of course, the famous statement from the Shema in Dvarim Perek Vav is you are to love Hashem b'chol levavcha u'v'chol nafshecha u'v'chol me'odecha. We have the phrase, b'chol nafshecha. How do we accomplish that mitzvah taseh? The Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin, and when you have time, you'll read the whole English translation. But to summarize for you, the Gemara maintains the following. That one would think that when it comes to the three cardinal sins of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, and Shvichut Damim, that you should die, Yehareg, Ve'al Yavor, and not transgress these sins. By the way, I want you to pay attention to the timing of this very important Gemara discussion in Masechet Sanhedrin. It's a discussion that they are having in the upper chambers in the house of Nitza in Lida, which is in Israel. This discussion takes place during the Hadrianic persecutions, consequent on the failure of the Bar Kokhba revolt right before the fall of Beitar. That is approximately 134 to 135 CE, which means this discussion is taking place after the events of Sefer Daniel. Everything in this Sefer is unprecedented. In fact, there's an interesting midrash, which we don't have time to go into, that in fact, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah go to Yechezkel and they say, what should we do? And a Navi is not a posek, but what they ask him, what should we do? What's the psak din? Because there is no precedent for what they are about to do. So what are the opinions? Rabbi Yochanan says, we're going to focus, of course, just on idolatry. Rabbi Yochanan says that you're supposed to die and that you are not allowed to commit this cardinal sin of Avodah Zarah. However, Rabbi Yishmael comes along and Rabbi Yishmael says, but you're supposed to live by the mitzvot, v'chai bahem, not die by them. And therefore, Rabbi Yishmael maintains that if you are asked to transgress the sin of idolatry in private, then you are allowed to do so. You are allowed to transgress the sin of idolatry in private and not die. However, is that the same case, befarhesya, in public? The answer is no. If you are asked to transgress the sin of idolatry in public, then you are not allowed to transgress. You need to die. Yehareg v'al yavo. Why? Because the answer is, v'lo techalalu et shem kodshi v'nikdashti, but the rest of the pasuk is, b'toch b'nei Yisrael. So later on in the Gemara, they ask, what does farhesya, a public forum, what are the conditions of farhesya? It's not less than 10 men, pshita Yisraelim. because it says B'toch B'nei Yisrael, 10 Jews, not 10 Gentiles necessarily. Okay. Later on, Rabbi Eliezer comes along and he says, no, V'ahavta t'Hashem Elokecha v'chol levavecha v'chol nafshecha u'v'chol me'odecha. The implication being, even if it's in private, you should die and not transgress idolatry. Rav Dimi comes along and he says, if it is a time of Sha'at Gezerat Malchut, a time of religious persecution, a decree from the royalty, then even afilu mitzvah kala yehareg velo ya'avol, even for a quote-unquote minor mitzvah, you should die and not transgress. Later on, Rabin comes along and he says, even if there is no Gezerat Malchut, but it's b'farhesia, there's a public forum, then even for a mitzvah kala, yehareg v'al yavol, even for a minor mitzvah, you die and not transgress. You need to pay attention to the fact that there are so many different conditions and stipulations about even whether you should transgress and commit idolatry, or if you should die for the sake of Kiddush Hashem. So, again, is this bowing down to the statue an issue of Avodah Zarah or not? If it is not, is it involving the transgression of any mitzvah? Is this Bifalhesia? We have at least one opinion of Rabbi Yishmael. And Rabbi Yishmael told us very, very clearly, if it's in private, you're allowed to live. You can commit idolatry and not die. Daniel is conspicuously absent. We're not sure there are even 10 Jews, which is the condition of Farhesia, who are present. And therefore, we have to ask, are Hananya, Mishael, and Azaliah, even if it is idolatry, obligated technically, halachically, to risk martyrdom and not bow down? Could they have avoided the fiery furnace and still be within the permissible parameters of halacha? What is interesting is if you study in the Rambam, in his Sefer HaMitzvot, the Rambam for Mitzvah Tasei number 9, I'm in source number 3, which he calls Mitzvah Kiddush Hashem, that we are commanded to do, where we should give ourselves to death, Mesirut Nafshenu, Lamut, when we are coerced to do so, Biyad HaOnes, in order to demonstrate our love of Hashem and our belief that there's only one God, Avat Yibarach Ve'emunah Yichudo, what illustrative example does the Rambam give in his Sefer HaMitzvot for those who were exemplary models of fulfilling this mitzvah? Hananya, Mishael, and Azariah. But notice how he understands the conditions of the story, that everything was, all the conditions were fulfilled. You can check off all the boxes. First of all, it's Nebuchadnezzar HaRasha Kje Gazal. It's Gezerat Malchut. Lihishtachavot LaTzelem, to bow down to this Tzelem. Second of all, Hishtachavu Kol HaAmim B'Yisrael Bichlal. He is assuming, Amamaya, Umaya, Lishanaya, even though he doesn't quote the text from our Perek itself, seems that he is assuming the masses. There were a lot of Jews present, not just the three who martyred themselves. And therefore, lo haya shem sham kamikadesh shem shamayim. Nobody was doing Kiddush Hashem. Obviously, from my personal opinion, I know there are others who read differently, but I believe that Rambam is maintaining this tzelem is idolatry. And nobody is standing up, and it was a cherpa gedola. It was a tremendous humiliation. We're doing a tremendous chilul Hashem. But notice, he is maintaining the two main conditions where you cannot, even with this cardinal sin of Avodah Zarah, transgress and not die, are operative, are set here. There's Farhesia and it's Gezerat Malchut. And therefore he says, what happened? Everyone was afraid. Pachadu hakol. There's tremendous inertia, there's tremendous fear on the part of the people, and therefore, being a Jew in exile, we've lost our sense of who we are, and Hananya, Mishael, and Azariah said, we have to stand up, and we need to do this Kiddush Hashem, not only to send a message to the Gentiles, but also to send a message to us. Furthermore, in the Rambam, in Hilchot Yisodei Torah, where he reiterates the discussion in the Gemara that we just outlined from Masechet Sanhedrin, Once again, Rambam maintains that kol hadvarim ha'elu, everything that we're talking about, if you can transgress even a cardinal sin, is when it is not sha'at hashmad, when it's not a time of persecution. But if it is a time of persecution, and notice once again the illustrative example that he gives, that Nebuchadnezzar stood up, he persecuted us, levatel datam. He wanted us to nullify our religion, which is how I feel that he is intimating that this tselem was meant to be a form of paganism. Yehareg ve'al yavol, even though also b'sha'at hashmad, you also are not, if you want to levatel datam, o mitzvah min ha-mitzvot, or if there is a royal decree against any of the mitzvot, you should die. You should die ve'al yavol, yehareg ve'al yavol, even when it comes to any of the other mitzvot. Interestingly, the Rambam adds on whether you are coerced among 10 Jews or whether you're coerced among between yourself and the Gentiles themselves. Once again, he says that there were 10 Jews present at this ceremony because he cites our example, and along with Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, that they were Mekadesh et Hashem Barabim, right? They fulfilled all the parameters and they did Kiddush Hashem Befarhesya. And that is why, interestingly enough, we have a midrash in Bereshit Rabbah that tells us Bereshit Rabbah was compiled, this midrashic collection was compiled in 500 CE, and they compare Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refusal to bow down to the statue and be thrown into the fiery furnace to the midrash that we learn about Avraham Avinu when he refused to worship idols and therefore he himself was thrown into the fiery furnace. With all that, there are other opinions. And the other opinions are, first of all, as the Midrash and Shir HaShirim Rabbah, source number 6 tells us, that it's not absolutely evident that there were more, that there were the masses were present, that many Jews were present at this ceremony. According to their opinion, there were only 3, according to this Midrashic opinion. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. In which case, a very important condition for having to die and not transgress, farhesia, is not applicable here. So once again, that according to at least one Amora, right, or that maybe they could have found, quote unquote, a loophole and transgressed, bowed down, and continued to live the Chai Bahem as Jews. Because what is very interesting is that the Tosafists pay attention to the fact that there are a number of Talmudic discussions. I only cited one in source 7. I gave you the sources of the other ones in the later sources to look up on your own. There are many Talmudic discussions in various tractates of the Gemara where they are asking the question, what justified Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to do this unprecedented act of martyrdom? So therefore, there are Tosafists who say, if they're asking the question, then what? This is not an open and shut case where you don't have to seek out a justification for what they did.
Isn't the fact that they were saved so miraculously evident that they did the right thing?
Yes, ultimately yes, and that's what the final upshot is going to be. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, if they're questioning initially, then obviously that means they're seeking justifications. So very interestingly, there was an individual, Theodosius of Rome, and he asked the question, Ma ra'u mishchananya mishael ve'azaliyah shemasorat samana kedushat Hashem l'kishan ha'ech. What did they see? What justified them to want to be thrown into the fiery furnace and not bow down? So here's the amazing thing. They drew a kal vachomer. They drew an analogy from frogs. Frogs. Mitzvahdi'im. Just like the frogs in Egypt during the plague of frogs willingly threw themselves into the hot ovens in the Egyptian homes, even though instinctively frogs would not throw themselves into a hot oven, and they willingly were willing to die in order to fulfill God's will as part of Makat Tzvardim, alachat, and they're not even commanded of kiddush Hashem. Alachat kama v'chama, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah sought out that this was a rationale, or at least this is how the Amoraim are understanding, this is a rationale for why they did not transgress and did not bow down to idolatry. It's a very difficult Gemara. The Maharsha actually says, based on this Gemara, that why are they asking, Ma'ra'u? How do we justify what they did? The Maharsha amazingly says, because the condition of Farhesya was not operative. Why? There were less than 10 Jews. And since the condition of Farhesya, which is a major condition, at least according to some of the Amoraim, if that's not operative, could they have found a way out and not martyred themselves? So therefore the Gemara is asking, Ma ra'u? The amazing thing is that in relationship to this, therefore, Rabbeinu Tam, in the Tosafot, in source number 9, says the fact that the Gemara is questioning and needs to justify what they did is because, according to the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam, this statue was not idolatry. It was just its love avodah zarah hava ela in darta sha'asa lichvod atzmo. He just made a political statue to aggrandize himself and his powers. Now, we did say we have to keep in mind there is necessarily not separation between church and state, but the bottom line is, he says, when they said, we do not, you know, the accusation was, you do not bow down, give me 3 more minutes, please. You do not bow down to your gods, and you do not bow down to this idol, this statue. They separate, Rabbeinu Tam says, it's 2 separate accusations. It's 2 separate accusations. Rabbeinu Tam, and I gave you another source from Masechet Avodah Zarah, it's on this as well. It was just done for the honor of the king. It's a political statement. If it's therefore only a political statement, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah had to really go out of their way to find some sort of justification for what they are doing. And according to the Gemara, Masechet Pesachim, they made an analogy from frogs. And just skipping for the moment to source 11, Rabbi Yehuda Brandis, who wrote an article on this in Parashat Va'era, and he calls it Mesirut Nefesh Shel Tzvardim. He says, this agadic learning from frogs in order to legitimate Mesirut Nefesh is because when you're thinking rationally, you're not thinking that you should immediately die. Perhaps you're thinking, how can I continue to live as a Jew? And that's why you need this exceptional drasha from frogs. He says, Mistaber shelifamim, b'makom shekatzara yada shel haratzionaliot, when you can't think rationally, niskaka adam li intelligentsia tzaradit. You need as if the intelligence of a frog. I.e., this is a very extreme action. So therefore, if that is the case, in fact, and Rabbeinu Tam, based on these Talmudic discussions, which question, what is the justification for what they did? And Rabbeinu Tam says, you know why we're questioning it? Because this isn't idolatry at all. It's just a statue that we bow down to the political, being politically obeisant to the sovereignty of this king. In which case, how do we then justify that yet nevertheless we praise them for their acts of Kiddush Hashem? Says the Tosafot in source number 10, Afal pichei haya bo Kiddush Hashem v'lachem maseru atzman lemita. It's still Kiddush Hashem. Wait a minute, how can it be Kiddush Hashem? They're not transgressing any kind of mitzvah here. In which case comes along the Nimuke Yosef in source number 12. This is a Spanish Talmudist from the 14th and 15th century, and he says, you're right. In fact, the Rambam says in his Mishneh Torah that if you could have transgressed and you decided not to, but you decided to die, you're guilty. Because you should really thinking about living, the Chai Bahem. So how do we justify what Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah did? So the Baal Nimukei Yosef says, Im hu adam gadol v'chassid yirei shamayim. It can only be certain individuals. This is not done by your ordinary layperson. But if there is an adam gadol chassid yirei shamayim, and he sees that the dor is parutz, that the people are just wayward, the whole generation is wayward, rashai. Nachuva, but rashai. He's permitted. Lekadesh Hashem v'limso atzmo afilu amitzvah kala. Even to not transgress a mitzvah kala, a minor mitzvah, but to die. Why? Kadesh yiru ha'am v'ilmedu liyirat Hashem lahavo b'chol libam. So that it sends a tremendous message to the Jews in exile, this generation that is wayward and not following the mitzvot. It sends a tremendous message to the masses, even if they're not present. But the message will get out as to how they really should be believing in Hashem, even in Galut. So the Nimuke Yosef says, yes, it may have been just a statue to honor the king. But Ruban To'inu Sivurim Shaitavo Dazara, when you look at it and you look at the whole ceremony, there are so many echoes of idolatry, especially if the king himself considered himself to be like a deity. There are so many parallels to idolatry, and even more so, even if it's just a political sovereign statement, if you're bowing down to a human king, then what are you not bowing down to? Who are you not bowing down to? Hashem, you're giving allegiance, absolute allegiance to the wrong, right, authority. That is a form of Avodah Zarah in and of itself, and because it looks like Avodah Zarah, therefore, it still was a Kiddush Hashem.
So would that matter if there weren't 10
No, it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter necessarily. I mean, he doesn't talk in that. It wouldn't necessarily matter because word would get out. Mm-hmm. I will just end off with the following. Rabbeinu Tam is discussing this from the context of Talmudic discussions, which are attempting to rationalize why they did what they did, which means Rabbeinu Tam says it must not be Avodah Zarah if everybody's grappling with figuring out a justification. Abar Benel, reading the storyline, says, I follow Rabbeinu Tam. Why is that? Because when he built a statue of gold, he is trying to nullify the dream. He's trying to nullify the dream interpretation that Hashem gave through Daniel about the world destiny, the schema of the four kingdoms, and that there's going to be a fifth messianic kingdom. And by doing so, if Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah had bowed down to this golden statue, what would they have demonstrated? They don't believe the truth of Daniel's dream interpretation. They don't believe that there's going to be a schema of four kingdoms, and in the end, there's going to be Malchut Hashem, the fifth kingdom. And just by that very fact, even if the statue was just making a political statement, by that very fact, that is also why they felt obligated to bow, not to bow down, but to risk their lives. Al Kiddush Hashem. Thank you. Yeah.
Where is Daniel?
Daniel's not here at all.
Where is he?
That's a very